Today is February 27th, 2023. This is part 11 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Alan Malmquist. Alan, A-L-L-E-N, spells his last name M-A-L-M-Q-U-I-S-T, and my name is Tom Martin. Good morning, Alan. How are you today?
Good morning. I'm doing good.
Great. Alan, I wanted to ask you, we had talked in the last interview about your attempts to take river trips off the river at Whitmore Wash using the Whitmore Trail, and that was 1968 to 70-ish, and I wondered if you had any photos of that work that you did there, making the airstrip or building the trail.
Actually, I'm embarrassed to say that I don't have any pictures, and that's hard for me because I had spent so many years really as a serious landscape photographer, large format, had a 35 millimeter camera, and then after these years in the Ken Whitmore, then I went back and did more photography.
Okay.
So it's embarrassing that I really don't have any pictures. And one of the reasons was, I think I mentioned to you way back, was one of the, well, it was the second trip that I went down Canaan Canyon with the local cowboys.
Right.
To take the horses in. And I had my 35 millimeter, and I had this really, what I called, thought was a slick outfit, where it was an old surplus ammunition kind of box that went on my belt, and my 35 millimeter and fit down in it just securely. And
oh, wow.
Rode with that many times, and I remember I went down, and about the second day we had a long session where I really hate the horses just, you know, not walking fast, not galloping, but there's an in-between trot that's just excruciating on the rider, bouncing
yes.
up and down.
Yes.
And I stopped somewhere to take a picture sitting on the horse, just to, the whole idea was to take the camera out and get a picture.
Right.
I opened up the thing, and the camera was in there, but it was in 100 pieces. It had completely come apart.
Oh, wow.
All the lenses had come apart. There was just a whole handful of brass rings and screws and pieces. You know, I could, the glass lenses themselves for them, there had come out, and I had a handful of them.
Wow.
And I just put it back in there. And when I came back at the end of the day or something, I put it all in a bag and eventually got another 35, but it was another probably 2 years later. So I really didn't have any more pictures of the cowboys or of Whitmore. I would have loved to have had them done
yeah.
it, but I think that's the main excuse, at least, I have. The other was that I was, you know, really working into stop in the middle and say, oh, hold that pose, guys, I'll get you a picture. It's not, it depends on the group. But I was going to mention that we, you know, you were asking about the road and the airstrip, and I wanted to mention also that Mel and I built the trail from the rim of the inner gorge there down to the beach.
This is Mel.
Less than a mile.
This is Mel Heaton.
Yeah.
Okay.
And when we arrived, there was just a wheel tracks, as you could see across the. Well, it comes down that huge lava flow for several miles to get to right above the river.
Right.
You could follow it, but it took a very low range four-wheel drive. But when we got to the rim, the trail, you could follow it on foot, kind of jumping from big boulder to big boulder. And Mel and I spent, at least, I want to say a week, but it was several days just improving that trail to where we could get horses, pack string, up and down that mile of trail, 1,000 feet. Maybe it's 800 feet, I don't know. It felt like 1,000 feet. But we moved those big basalt boulders that big as the desk in front of me here that
wow.
Huge steel bars that you can jam in and two people pull back and just keep moving and jiggling, and finally it'll fall off and open up the place you want or fall into the place you want to fill in. And in the end, we had a really serviceable horse trail for that little bit.
You know, thank you for mentioning that, because I did an oral history with Bonnie Bundy, who was using that trail in the 50s into the early 60s or certainly late 50s. And she talked about how narrow that trail was. And having walked that trail, I'm like, wow, what was it narrow? Because it's nice and wide, and that's your work to widen it.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Another thing that, before I forget it, you know, we've built a corral up above the trail there, and we'd bring in the horses and had, you know, 12 or 15 there. It was, and a truckload of hay, and we had to water them down at the river, which twice a day. We'd had a little drift fence, you'd call it, barbed wire, that directed the horses from the corral. I could just open the gate, and they would run over and off the trail and go down to the river. And then there was an issue that some of them wanted to go up and downstream there to graze on whatever they could find, including tamarisk. But so we built kind of two drift fences to keep the horses within maybe 20, 30 yards of the river. There was a big beach there.
Okay.
Not a big beach. It was a little beach, but it was a beach. And where the boats would land, offload the people, and the horses and mules would, be controlled going when I'd turn them off to go down there, because I'd have to ride one of them down bareback and ride back up bareback and to water them twice a day. But they got kind of a game of trying to get around that drift fence.
Now, wait a minute. This drift fence has to go all the way to the river, to the water, so if the river had dropped, they could sneak around it.
Yeah, that's my point, that we eventually had this going down, and it was, these steel fence posts that you can get at the hardware store into the sand there. And a couple of them ended up kind of pointing straight out, almost horizontal there.
Ooh.
On either end. Well, I remember vividly one of the hatch pilots who was not very happy with the world, and I talked last time about some of their problems at that age, those years. But one of them came in and kind of missed the beach, but impaled himself on the drift fence.
Oh.
And it wasn't like he didn't have 40 feet of beach to land on. And there was no one else there. And this post was very obvious and even had a kind of a flag on it. But he took out one of his pontoons.
Oh.
And oh, was he incensed. I loaded up his passengers and we scooted up the hill as soon as possible. Because he had to patch it and then pump it up again, and complaining about losing an hour, but he had already wasted a couple hours getting down to the beach late. So, but that was something I vividly remember.
Huh. Okay. You know, Alan, I forgot to ask you for your permission to record this oral history.
Oh, yes.
May we do that?
Yes.
Thank you. since we're talking about the Whitmore Trail, you mentioned the private boaters, the do-it-yourself people, were always comical to watch. Can you expound on that a little bit?
Well, I don't know why, but I guess there would be coming down from lava falls upstream was kind of a concentration point for commercial trips, and private trips would kind of back up there and go through one at a time. And they'd by that time get to know each other, and a lot of bantering back and forth and all. But a lot of the private trips, when they came back past Whitmore, was just kind of the leftover of the circus below Lava Falls. And the private trips, they were the rafts were decorated. The people were either in outrageous costumes or in nothing at all, and would, you know, are sitting there waiting for our group, or the group there, and the private would go by, and they'd be having a good time, and it was just bizarre, I'll put it that way. You know, the most of the commercial trips, everybody was, you know, in their outdoor costumes and what they thought was, you know, going to be appropriate for a Grand Canyon trip, reading the directions from the trip leaders. But the private groups could not have been more different. Just really, bizarre is the word. And they went, you know, nothing wrong. Nobody did anything. It was just part of the trip experience at that time, I guess.
Yeah. Well, they weren't.
The commercial groups, when the private group like this would go by, they would just all roll their eyes and say, thank goodness we don't have to see that anymore.
Okay.
Kind of a, if you're coming down for this very sensitive experience in the canyon, and then there's this circus group, it reminded, well, no, I won't get on and on that. You get the picture.
Yeah. Okay. And at this time, that sounds like a full-time job to me. Were you still working at Pipe Springs at the monument? No.
No, I quit there completely and moved to Moccasin, this was a full-time job.
Okay.
You mentioned, well, with the Bundy bench, Mel Heaton and David Johnson, who was also a partner, but was more involved with getting the livestock, but they both knew the Bundys very well.
Okay.
Historically, and on that, their families had similar histories, but all along, there was we felt necessary, and I did too, to really involve the Bundys in what we were doing down there, because in a sense, we were just butting in on what was most people would have considered their territory.
Right.
Even though they had no permits or legal claim to definitely the trail or that whole area was it's Lake Mead National Recreation Area, and they didn't have anything. But we wanted to involve them in the whole thing of improving the trail to making a good trail there. We told them, you know, in the future, or any time, you can come down and go up and down there, or, you know, conceivably they could have set up something to take a group out. So we had that, they would have to deal with the Park Service on that, but we informed them, and they always said, well, good luck.
They were done with it by then, huh?
They knew what was there, but so we involved them, and they were interested in all of that.
And then when did the helicopters, do you remember when the helicopters got involved in a big way to pull people out?
After we left.
Okay.
A couple years. We had always said, boy, that would be the way to do it. But we had there was no communication.
Right.
That was the whole problem.
Right.
And so when I left there, the only time I went back was many years later when I went down to Colorado finally with Gary Ladd and his Dory, and we stopped there, and I don't think I even went up on the trail. We had been through Lava Falls, and that was pretty horrendous. And we were still happily recuperating and enjoying, and had a real high from the success there. And we just kind of went by. Floated by Whitmore, and I said, yeah, that's the trail I built, and sure,
cool.
All of this. And so I really was never back there again. I would hear reports of Tony Heaton developing there, though I never went in and saw his operation, and I heard about the helicopters, and that's really great that they can do that now. But I was busy in other things.
What was the relationship between Mel and Tony?
I thought about that. They are cousins.
Okay.
At least, they had lived at Moccasin for several years. His wife, Tony's wife, and I. For the life of me, I can picture her, but I can't remember her name. She taught home ec in Fredonia High School.
Okay.
And they decided to move to St. George, where he came from and where his father had a cattle ranch, or his headquarters was in St. George, but and then Sharon got the job at Bologna High School to teach home ec.
And where was, now this, Sharon, this is a woman you're going to marry.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, by this time, we were. And I
well, so how did you guys meet, and when did you meet?
Okay, we met in my second year at Pipe Springs. I was a park historian there. And she got the job in Fredonia. She was from down by Yuma, Arizona, and gone to the U of A and taken the high school position there. And
what was her degree in from the U of A?
It was in education, but it turned out she lucked out because she had home ec and PE. And when she had gone and all, she started in a PE major and just kind of lost enthusiasm for it down there with the people she had to deal with. And she always enjoyed the home ec, so she changed her majors, and I went graduated in home ec. But the interesting things for her to luck out was this was the start of the Title IX demanding that high schools provide equal PE and sports for women
right.
as men. And schools were panicked, especially small ones like Fredonia, which was tiny, about how are they going to hire all these new teachers. And she applied for the home ec, which was fine. And the principal said, what we really need is someone that could do half home ec and half girls PE. And she said, well, I, you know, majored in it for a while and all. And they looked up her transcript and found that she had more than enough credits to certify in both.
Oh, wow.
Which meant that they were overjoyed to have her there. And so it would be the fall of, we're still talking 68, maybe.
Yeah.
She came up to Fredonia, and we tell the story I told many, many, many times because it's kind of cute, but it turns out that she and I were the only two young adult single people in the country. Literally. And we were, you know, the whole social life of both communities, Moccasin and Fredonia, was centered around Mormon church activities and youth activities, young adult activities. And we both, were invited to participate and did. We enjoyed it, and it was definitely, we just enjoyed everything about it. And we then figured out that there was this unusual development where every weekend, either the young adult group in Fredonia would have an activity, Saturday night or Friday night or something, or on Saturday, or the Moccasin group would have an activity. And we were always invited to it. She would be invited out to a Moccasin activity with some of her Fredonia friends, and I would be dragged into Fredonia to whatever the activity was with the moccasin friend. And we figured out what was going on pretty quick. And so we agreed that it's silly for us to be, well, like occasionally driving two cars to the same activity. So we just set it up where we would, you know, make the arrangements ourselves and go, you know, together, which overjoyed the people on both sides.
Okay.
And, you know, one thing led to another, and the next year we got engaged and went and then married. And if you have to, and I'm not putting it on the tape, our wedding date, because I always get it wrong. And
okay.
I don't want it put down to posterity. But last, in 2000, we had our 50th anniversary.
Oh, wow.
So I can always figure it back if I have to, but we were married November 28th, and it turned out that was the Saturday after Thanksgiving. And I then...
Was that in 1970?
Either 69 or 70. That's what I think is, I don't know. 70.
Got it. So 2019 or 2020 would have been your 50th. Nice.
Right. Well, it was 2020 or 2021. I'll find out next time. I'll tell you on that. But I have to say that I don't remember.
No worries. It was 50 years ago.
Along that line, that's just as notorious is when we moved to Tucson and I enrolled our son in first grade. I wrote down his birthday wrong, so it's notorious that I just don't get dates and birth dates. I just don't give you and make a thing of it.
Alan, I wanted to ask you, you mentioned Sharon was from Yuma. What were her parents doing there in Yuma?
Okay, they were 40 miles west of Yuma, and the last name was Curry, C-U-R-R-I-E. He had been in the Second World War in the Navy when he came out. He married his wife back in Virginia while he was still in the service before he left, and then brought her to Arizona. He had been raised in Glendale next to Phoenix, where his father was a bricklayer and small farmer. He went to the U of A on the GI Bill, and actually...
Hey, Alan.
Yeah.
I'm going to stop you now, because so far this interview's been great, but all of a sudden now this kind of scurrying noise has started to come in again.
Oh, I'm sorry. I wonder if it's my desk chair. Is that it?
Well, it's something.
Well,
and I hear it. Now I don't.
Okay, I'm kind of wiggling around, I guess. I will avoid that.
All right, thank you. So he was from Glendale. Had gone to the U of A on a GI scholarship, GI Bill.
And they actually lived in Polo Village, if you know where that was, north of the campus.
The Quonset huts.
Yeah, all the Quonset huts. And the bizarre thing is, in later years, I came down there and spent about a month when Terry Gustafson was there in his concert hut. But that's irrelevant.
Yeah, here. But the same buildings. That's cool.
Yeah. But he studied, agriculture, but engineering. He's an irrigation engineer.
Okay.
And after he graduated, he got a job with Oregon State up in Central Oregon, where there was a big irrigation district with experimental farms.
Okay.
And he worked there building irrigation ditches and monitoring and doing everything involved with it. Darren was born up there in Madras, Oregon. And a couple years later, he got a job through the U of A to develop an experimental farm east of Yuma, near what's now Tacna and Welton. But historically, the farms there were down on the bed of the Gila River, down at that level.
Right.
The Bureau of Reclamation brought the irrigation canals on the what they called the mesa above.
Okay.
So, you know, the canal was up to where the laterals would go down to the farms.
Right.
But they wanted to see if it was feasible to farm the mesa. And so her dad was hired to do that. And we have hundreds of thousands of pictures of that farm and of Sharon growing up.
Cool.
And after about 10 years, well, actually it was when she went to college. He had first bought the experimental farm. They were done experimenting, and he bought that, used it as a cotton farm. And then he sold that and bought a property at Welton about 10 miles away, and had, when I was introduced to them, they were farming there and had a house on the rim.
So this is Welton, Arizona?
Yeah.
Okay.
Welton and Tacna. And Sharon and I were married in Rowell, Arizona, R-O-L-L, which is down there out in the middle of nowhere with all the cotton farms all around. Now they're all lettuce farms. But, and then...
Was Rowell, R-O-L-L, was that like where there was a justice of the peace? Why did you get married there?
That's where, Alan Weir wasn't right there. Sharon had gone to elementary school out there, which was just out in the middle of the farms. Just not a bill, anything near it. I was just in this big elementary school, and across the street was a kind of general Protestant church that over the years had several preachers come through, and that's where she wanted to get married and where her family agreed, and we went there to that little church across from the school. At Rowell was maybe a mile away, and that started as just a siding on the railroad, which is where the railroad from, it had turned off of the main line going from Phoenix to Tucson, and there was a tracks that went to probably Gila Bend and then to Phoenix.
Okay.
And there was actually a whistle stop there where you could get on and off the railroad. There was one small store, kind of a convenience store, and not much, probably had a gas pump out front. The main thing was the huge cotton gin, which was right there.
Ah.
But that's all it was.
And did your folks come out from California?
They came out for the wedding, yeah.
Cool.
Yeah. So that was her background. And an interesting aside, her father, Jack, loved flying, and he had a string of airplanes, small Cessnas, four-seaters.
Okay.
And loved to fly around and fly to Baja and fish and go up. And I know at the time, after we were married, he came up a couple times and he flew me around the Western Grand Canyon.
Oh, wow.
And finding routes and trails and the whole area from to Peach Creek west.
Okay. Okay, now you need to hold still again, Alan. That rattling's coming back.
Yeah. Okay. The other thing I wanted to finish up on the Whitmore.
Yes.
That was that the way we brought the horses in and mules in and out of Whitmore was via two-week. We would call, the partner David, who was the horse trader, who was a cattleman my age, and Mel's cousin, and he he ran his father's cattle out on the Arizona Strip.
Okay.
He also was a horse trader, and he would go all over southern Utah, and especially out in the reservation, and he would buy horses and haul them back and sell them. And everybody knew if you wanted a horse or something, you could tell him, and if you were patient, he'd show up with a couple that you could pick.
And oh, wow.
The idea for our back strips, Chip and Whitmore, was he was in charge of getting the animals. And oftentimes he would have to buy two or three head, two really weird animals to get one that he thought was absolutely perfect.
Oh, wow.
So over the first year there, I never knew what was going to come out of the back end of the stock truck.
Huh.
And some of these things had lots of experience packing, some of them never packed, and that was just part of the way it worked, because we could get these groups, three or four horses, and end up with a great one really cheap.
Oh, I
so
see.
In the end, it worked great. But we were always, I would tell them every trip, here's these two didn't work. I don't want to see them again. Or here's one that just was fabulous.
Hmm.
We're putting our brand on him.
Okay.
He would bring his big stock truck down to 2 weeks to the ranger station in front of Riffy's house, and he was compliant in all of this because Riffy had known every step of the way what we were doing and why and how, and encouraging and recommending and suggesting. So we would arrive with 15 or more horses and mules and unload them in the the Park Service corral right there. And then, depending if it was early enough or whether we spent the night, but unload, you know, a load, pack up a load of hay and grain on some of the pack animals, and then I turn them out and run them down west, down that horrible dirt, dusty road that went out to the trailhead of going down to Lava Falls. But instead of going there, we would turn and go up in the Pinyon Forest and go around the point of what's that range of volcanoes there from Mount Trumbull, Mount Emma.
So that's, that's Paw's Pocket.
Yeah. And we would go around there, and then we'd open the gate in the Park Service fence there and put them through, and then we would lead them and down the, there's a huge lava flow there. There's enough that it's mainly, you know, you're going from grassy, sandy places to another. There's not a lot of, you don't have to be on the lava that much. So we lead them around there.
Okay, Alan. Alan, that noise is still there, so I'm going to ask you about that again.
Yep.
I'll stop. Okay, thank you. So you got them through the fence, and then down this huge lava slope, this hill that went forever, just this long, gradual descent.
Right. And then we'd work around to the right side of it, because where it was feasible, we would drop off to the road that we had put in from the airport to the rim, and then run them down there. Now,
was that because the road was too tough to take a horse trailer down?
The upper end of Whitmore, where you came off the rim of what you would call the Bundyville level up there, there was a very steep road coming down for maybe 2 or 3 miles, and definitely wouldn't do it. Clayson and I improved that quite a bit with the big blader, because we got the blader up and down, if that was enough of a trick. But that was the most difficult part of the whole way from like Bundyville to the rim at Whitmore, was that road coming off the side of, I don't know what it is out there, Mount Emma or that level.
So this is the road from the flats up at the level of Bundyville down to where the Heatons would eventually build their big ranch and the airstrip. So that section there was really steep. Okay, and it still is steep today.
Yeah. Because that was my response. That, you know, for them to do that, that's great. But I obviously knew that they had to have rebuilt that road somehow.
And how did you get the horses out? Did you take them out the same way?
Yeah. Every time we did, that was a lot. We would have had left the stock truck up at the top of the hill there, and that was several miles more than taking them out by trail around the two.
Huh. Wow. Okay. I still hear that noise, though.
Sorry.
All right, thank you. And it stops. That's good. Okay, so you married Sharon down by Yuma, but it doesn't sound like you were Mormon.
No, not at that time. And we had discussed the possibility, and we both agreed for both our families to have us get married was enough of a big deal. They were all supportive, but it was a big deal. But if we put another layer of Mormon church and temple and all of that, we didn't want to think about what the reaction would been. So it was about a year later that we were baptized in Kanab and joined the church.
All right. That's a very considerate way of doing that.
Yeah.
Okay. And then did you stay in Moccasin or did you move to Fredonia?
Well, we spent a couple years in Moccasin, and the little house I had there was just basically a cabin. There was two bedrooms. There was a little living room, kitchen, and bathroom next to Owen Johnson's house that he had built for his mother to spend her last days. They convinced her to come and they could take care of her. It was clean and in good shape, but not much to it. And I was... I don't know why I was really into what is now home improvement and renovation.
Okay.
But I just saw all the potential, and I just basically, they said, oh, we wish you could have good paneling and a kitchen, a new kitchen stuff and tile and whatever, and the bathroom renovated. And I just said, well, if you're patient, I'll do it. And they were overjoyed, and I did it, and they never charged me any rent. They were just real happy to see the place fixed up, and I left it in good shape. Really nice little cabin when I was.
Nice. So you bought the materials and did the work and paid no rent.
Right.
Super.
Worked out perfect. Because I had, when I had time. And then I'd be gone on a trip. But it all worked out great.
Sharon was getting a paycheck from the school for teaching.
Yes.
And then what did you guys do for your summers? What would you do then? When she was off?
Well, what this evolved to, and I'll jump to that, is that when I really decided that I couldn't do Whitmore anymore and that my partners agreed, I had run a couple of pack trips for the Sierra Club.
Okay.
One up in Escalante, down the Escalante River, a huge group, and I'd take them down Kanab Canyon, and I really liked the idea of organizing and then eventually doing the packing myself. I mean, I was getting skilled enough, and that's what I started to do. We did move into Fredonia because there was a big hassle with the school district that they passed a regulation that teachers had to live in town.
Oh, wow.
Even though all the kids from Moccasin went into Fredonia High School.
Huh.
It was the two different counties, and they were trying to keep their teachers from all moving to Kanab. And so we were really stuck with, resigned there when before our son was born, and the first year that he was out. But then she wanted to teach, and we could see that that was really important. And so we bought a mobile home on 2 acres in Fredonia, and I put up a corral, and we moved the livestock in there, and I ran the pack trips for the next almost 7 years out of Fredonia, and she taught, and in the summer, she'd come on the trips.
Oh, cool.
And the way I had it down was spring, summer, and fall, every 2 weeks, you know. My success was not to set up a pack station traditionally, where you'd go up in the mountains at the end of the road. There was a pack station that would take trips to the headwaters of whatever stream it was, and that's all they did.
Mm-hmm.
Mine was that I figured out the great trips, and I would haul the livestock to where the trip was going to be. So I would spend the spring in Zion and Bryce, and then get to where I was in the High Uintas for a month in July, and then we'd move up to the Wind River Range for a month, and then we'd move back again. And I'd have, the trips were 2 weeks long. They'd have, it was the highlight model of the Air Club, where the people walked, and I carried all the their material and the food, all their luggage. Everybody had a duffel bag and carried the food and had a kitchen and had a really, really great time. And then I got to the point where it was, where I could have a 2 week trip in the Uintas, let's say, for the Sierra Club. And then I had enough people that wanted to go out with me from former trips that I would do the next, basically do the same trip over again for the 2 weeks in the High Uintas with a private group.
Okay.
It would be 12 or 15 people. And the routine was, Sharon and I would work out the menu, which was very specific, and she and I would go to St. George and buy a whole pickup truck full of food that could be packed, and we'd go back and pack everything into boxes. We got the whole stock of these white cardboard boxes, like apple boxes or letter boxes.
Okay.
And each box had 1 day of food and labeled. And then for the actual trip, we'd usually have as much fresh food as I could get away with.
Mm-hmm.
Eggs and a couple baked dinners and lettuce salads and things that made it really fun in the mountains. But when Sharon got to the mountains, she was on vacation.
Okay.
She would pack up the tent every morning, and she she always rode one of the horses or a mule, and John would ride with her in her lap. And he was 3 and 4 years old, but he spent all summer pack tripping all over.
Wow. When was your son John born?
I don't know. That's the one where I get the real
You guys were married in 70, 71 ish. So maybe
he's almost 50. He may be 50 this year.
Okay, so that would have been 73.
That's about right, 72, 72.
And so when he was three on these pack trips, that would have been 1976-ish, around there,
yeah.
just trying to keep the timeline together.
Yeah, and, you know, he had a very good youth, I'll put it, out in the mountains. Everybody loved him.
Nice.
The packers that we had just really enjoyed him, and he was very receptive to this whole thing.
Cool.
He loved it. He thought that was his normal existence.
Oh, wow.
We had a backpack tent, a three-person, and I could carry a foam pad 2 inches thick that we rolled up and put on top of the pack horse.
Ooh, nice.
Yeah, very. And Sharon made a small down sleeping bag for John.
Oh, cool.
And there was quite an open space at his feet. But the other thing that was kind of we were notorious for was our Weimaraner Millie, who we couldn't believe back in Fredonia because she was just not able to handle that on her own. And we got to taking her with us, and she just loved being in the mountains.
Huh.
And she would, if we had 6 or 8 miles to go, she ran at least 20. She'd take off on a run up the trail, and we'd see her far as you could see ahead. And then she'd turn around and run all the way back to where we were with the pack string riding along slowly.
Wow.
And with the group walking. And then she'd take off again and go. And so she did several routines. She did the best environment for a Weimaraner I could imagine.
Loving to run.
Loving
yeah.
to run. At night, she was petrified. The first night, we made a little thing next to the tent, and she curled up there, but boy, was she afraid, and she was shaking all over and crying.
Oh.
And I unzipped the tent, and she kind of stuck her head in and leaped over John, and there was that open space at his foot, and she turned around twice, laid down, and didn't move till the next morning. And so
oh, wow.
That was her place for years. Every night she spent at the foot of our bed in the tent by not moving an inch.
Okay. Smart dog.
And I will, just one more thing before we're done. I kind of tying this into the Grand Canyon in early days. I had a couple pack trips with the stock, a very involved one going down, hiking into the Peace Creek and Thunder River and spending a couple nights there. And then the group backpacking from there down the Colorado to Kanab Creek.
Oh.
Well, we went up into Deer Creek, actually, and camped a couple of nights, and the livestock came down into Deer Creek there, the upper end. Probably the last livestock to do that.
Right. This would have been 1975 or 74.
Yeah.
When the Enlargement Act happened in January of 75. Then Grand Canyon National Park gobbled all that up, and you couldn't get stock in there without permission.
Right. Well, I had permits all along.
Okay.
But they were, all my trips, and I ended up with, special use permits. I'd have like 15 from different agencies
wow.
every year, from BLM, several national forests, couple national parks, and that was it. I just was willing to go through the
mm-hmm.
paperwork, the red
yep.
tape,
yep.
get the permit, and have one trip.
And did you have a company name?
It was called Moccasin Tours.
Oh, wow.
since we lived in Moccasin.
Yeah, but, yeah, cool.
And it was incorporated and everything.
Okay.
But the other, oh, and then from Deer Creek, the group, we backpacked for a camp at the mouth of Kanab Canyon, and we went up Kanab Creek about, well, up to Scotty's Canyon, where the livestock backtracked out the peaks to the, and then went north and down into Quadrant Hollow and what is the tributary of Kanab Creek there?
Yeah, Jump Up.
Jump Up. That I just haven't thought of that. Came down, Jump Up, and down Kanab and met us at Scotty Hollow.
So how did you work it out? Because you needed to kind of be two places at once. You needed to be with the backpackers going from Deer Creek to Kanab and then up Kanab.
That's where I stayed.
And yeah. You also needed to get the stock from Deer Creek into Kanab.
I had two packers along that I...
Got it.
That my Orville Palmer was the main backpacker, and he would do things like that for me. But
okay.
He was very safe. And, but that was a one-time trip because it was really too much logistics. We pulled it off, and it was a marvelous trip. We came around and hiked out to Jump Up and out on the rim again, and that's where the cars were. So it was an interesting...
Oh, that's a lot of shuttling there, and it's a that section along the river between Deer Creek and Kanab, there's some kind of big boulders in there, and it's not, there's not an easy trail.
We were bouldering, it's true. I remember there was one lady that was so enthusiastic, but she was kind of at her limit there. I quickly went ahead and left my pack at, to where it got easy toward the mouth of Kanab Canyon, and I went back and put her pack on and then helped her by hand over the rocks just so we could get there easier and safer and on time, and she loved that and didn't
right.
bother me a bit, but
right.
that was the thing. If you have time for one story.
Oh, yes, please.
On that trip on the way out, at Scotty's Canyon, there's huge boulders there. At some point, I must have knocked my wrist against one of the boulders or something. I didn't know exactly what I did, except my right wrist really hurt. And it kind of swelled a little. Fortunately, there were two doctors along. And I remember to this day, he said, well, just stick your hand out like you're going to shake my hand. And he grabbed my wrist between his thumb and first finger, and he twisted it to the right. And I screamed and almost flipped over. And he said, yep, your wrist is broken.
Oh, wow.
So for the rest of the trip, it was like 3 or 4 days. The whole group would not allow me to do anything.
Wow.
And they splinted my wrist and lower arm. And I knew where there were some slats of wood were actually from some old crates of dynamite in a cave up there. And we took the wooden slates off, and then they tore up one of my T-shirts and wrapped the wrist, mainly so I wouldn't use it.
Yeah.
And then everybody did the packing and the cooking and the cleaning and made a big deal that
oh.
I had to just sit in my special boulder and watch.
Oh, my gosh.
We got out, and I had, you know, the stock truck that I had then was like, a Ford one time that held four horses in the back and on the stock bed, and then I pulled a trailer that held four horses. And I drove that back to Fredonia, saying, oh, yeah, I can take care of that. No big deal. Well, it was a stick shift on the floor.
Ooh.
And my right hand, I found out this is, you know, I figured out a way, and I got home.
Ooh.
And I got the, I don't know if I even emptied the horses, but I remember calling the school, because we lived about three blocks from the school.
Okay.
And knew the secretary really well. And I called, and she said, oh, Alan, you're glad to hear you're home, because everybody in town knew where I was and what I was doing.
Cool.
And I said, I need you to do me a favor and go down to Sharon's classroom and tell her that if she can get away with it, I need her to come home and drive me to the doctor in Kanab because I broke my arm and I can't drive the truck any further.
Oh.
And she, the secretary, said, forget it. I'll go get Sharon. You're telling her what you did.
Oh, my gosh.
I'm tell her. And, of course, everybody knew, and Sharon came down and drove me up to the doctor. And it really wasn't broken. The bones were cracked, and they just, you know, put a good cast on it, and it healed perfectly. But it,
nice.
It's a story that we share about what we went through.
You know, Alan, we've been going for about an hour and 10 minutes here, but I would love to hear more stories about this 7-year time when you did these pack trips. So could we put a comma here and pick this same thread up again next time?
Yeah. Oh. When would you like to do
that? Okay, hang on a second. Let me go ahead and wrap this interview up.
Yeah.
This will conclude part 11 of A Grand Canyon Oral History with Alan Malmquist. Today is February 27th, 2023. My name is Tom Martin. Alan, thank you so very much.
You're welcome.